Hi, this is Bridget with the Christian Science Monitor. June 2nd. British politicians push for more North Sea drilling. Would that lower energy costs? Energy costs have skyrocketed in the United Kingdom because of the Iran war. Could more drilling for oil and gas in the North Sea bring them down? By Katie Marie Davies, Manchester, England. The United Kingdom currently faces some of the highest energy prices in Europe, and the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran means that more people than ever are feeling the pinch. And for an increasing number of British politicians, and one American president, those energy woes have an obvious solution. Drill, baby, drill. As costs rise, the center-right Conservative Party and the right-wing Reform UK have moved their positions closer to U.S. President Donald Trump. Even some in the Labour Party are weighing a move to allow new oil and gas extraction off Scotland's North Sea coast. Wes Streeting, one of the hopefuls to replace the beleaguered Keir Starmer as Prime Minister, told the Sunday Times that he is in favor of granting new drilling licenses, and that he thinks Mr. Starmer's government will soon follow. "We've also got to listen to what the union is saying," he told the Times. "Listen to what the workforce is saying. And listen to what the public is saying." But while enthusiasm for tapping the North Sea might be growing among political movers and shakers, it is far from clear whether drilling would be an effective solution for British energy needs, or whether the British public even supports doubling down on fossil fuel consumption. While British politicians might be ready to embrace more drilling in the North Sea, they might prove to be courting only a small, if noisy, minority of the public. Concerns over energy security. It is clear, experts say, that there is a growing public anxiety surrounding energy security. The start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022 and the latest conflict in the Middle East have caused several shocks to the energy market in recent years. "There is a growing awareness about vulnerability of our energy," says Eleanor Bale, a climate program officer at the Conservative Environment Network in London. "There has been an increasing call from the public for oil and gas, very much from the Iran crisis. We're seeing supply chains going and economic implications across the country of energy prices rising." Given the situation, the expansion of North Sea drilling might appear to be a tailor-made solution. But while the UK's energy resources in the region have been fruitful over the past several decades, they are now largely tapped out. British government data estimates the national supply of oil and gas left in the North Sea, including deposits that aren't yet mature enough to be developed, to be no more than 20% of its former total. Environmental watchdogs, such as the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit, put the remainder at about half that. The remaining reserves are also located in places where it's more difficult to drill, pushing up operating costs, says Bob Ward, Policy and Communications Director at Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change in London. "They're only really economically viable when the market price is high, and therefore when consumer prices are high. In fact, if the price of oil and gas goes down, I'm not convinced that there will be a huge amount of further development in the North Sea, because it's just not seen as economically viable." Though both the Conservatives and Reform UK promise, if elected, to increase drilling in the North Sea and repeal the government's current ban against new licenses, neither offers details about what the results of such a shift would mean for the public or the economy. Claire Coutinho, the Conservative Shadow Energy Secretary, did say in Parliament in March that a major gas field could be brought online by the end of the year, and could produce enough gas to heat more than 1.5 million homes. But she did not say what that estimate was based on or how long the proposed supply would last. And even if new drilling projects were developed, it's unlikely that new licenses issued now could alleviate financial woes in the short term. Research from the North Sea Transition Authority, the official body charged with licensing and regulating the UK's oil and gas industries, puts the average time between the discovery of fuel deposits and first production at 5 years. Even if it appeared productive to explore the North Sea for more energy, polling indicates that the public is not motivated by proposals for new drilling projects. In an April 9th YouGov poll, 38% of people in England and Wales said they were in favor of the government's ban on new drilling, while 39% were against. There's also evidence to suggest that the public would prefer to focus on renewables to secure Britain's energy, rather than oil and gas. Respondents in a different April YouGov poll of British adults favored prioritizing transitioning to renewable energy over maximizing the UK's existing oil and gas reserves, at 62% to 26%. "I'd say that it's a lot better to stop drilling in the North Sea," says Nicholas Barron, a university-aged Manchester resident. "It's partially a matter of climate science and partially a matter of this planet only has enough resources for however many people there are." Carrying the flag for fossil fuels. Some voters are still keen to trust oil and gas, simply because they are familiar with it, says Ms. Bale of the Conservative Environment Network. "It's not necessarily that there's not support for renewables," she says. "I think there is support, but renewables are kind of that new scary thing. Oil and gas have been around for years, and people know what they get with it." They also inspire a tinge of loyalty, she says. "There is a patriotic feeling for some towards oil and gas. We've seen how much it benefited our economy in the 1980s. The right-wing Reform UK, which sees such voters as part of its key base, wants to tap into such emotions. The drilling question is being pushed by the party's leadership as a culture war issue, says Matthew Patterson, a professor of international politics at Manchester University, who focuses on the politics of climate change. "It's lumped in with trans rights, LGBTQ stuff, anti-racism, all of that bundle of things that Reform attack routinely," he says. This, in turn, has triggered a wider shift across British politics. The Conservatives, keen to win back voters who have drifted to Reform UK in recent years, have shifted their own position in a bid to appeal to them, including on the environment, says Mr. Patterson. But he warns that party politics don't necessarily reflect public attitudes. "It's never more than about 10% of the population, 15% the absolute outside, for whom this sort of anti-net zero, anti-climate action has any strong appeal," he says. "Nobody is voting Reform because of their net zero stance." Why don't Americans welcome AI as much as people in other countries? Americans are skeptical that the benefits of artificial intelligence will outweigh its potential harm. People in China and South Korea see it differently. By Caitlin Babcock. Many Americans are not happy about AI. In some places, people are filling community meetings to resist data center construction. The Department of Homeland Security warns of a rise in anti-technology extremism. Public polling indicates that U.S. citizens increasingly believe artificial intelligence will take their jobs, raise electricity prices, and dilute the value of art, all while offering little in return. But in countries such as China and South Korea, where AI is also expanding rapidly, a majority of people view it as a positive tool that will spur economic growth. It's a striking disparity that reflects a wider trend. AI is playing an ever bigger role in people's daily lives, and it is being used in government and business operations. As AI usage grows, chasms are emerging between how different parts of the world perceive and react to this transformative technology. The United States is a clear global leader in AI, outpacing other countries in the construction of data centers, which provide the physical infrastructure and which use massive amounts of energy to run this technology. It also leads in private investment into AI. But at the same time, wealthy Western countries are mostly skeptical about AI, with average Americans more resistant to AI than people in almost any other part of the world. Experts say the way AI is developed and rolled out in the U.S. highlights its possibility to do harm over the benefits it might provide. The U.S. has committed upfront to leading in this AI space, but the public has been left behind, says Shah Sajadeh, who leads the AI Index at the Stanford Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence. About 3 in 10 Americans trust their government to regulate AI, the lowest score out of 35 countries surveyed by Ms. Sajadeh's Institute in 2026. In multiple polls, the U.S. ranks at or near the bottom in its AI optimism, a feeling that the technology will do more good than harm, compared with other countries. In Asian countries such as China, Indonesia, and Thailand, between 75% and 85% see AI's benefits as outweighing its drawbacks. Data measuring attitudes in other parts of the world is sparse, but 3 different surveys revealed net optimism about AI in 3 African countries and 5 from South America. When you look at China, the number of people who are nervous is around 40%, says Ms. Sajadeh. In the U.S., that's the amount of people who are actually excited. Experts link the disparities in part with how different governments approach the rollout of AI. AI as a tangible benefit. Ranjit Singh, the director of Data and Society's AI on the Ground program, says the way countries approach AI and the messaging they use can make a big difference in public perception. In the U.S., he says that, apart from the need to stay competitive with China, neither the government nor AI companies have made a clear case for why AI is a positive thing for most people, or why it's worth the cost of the massive resources being invested in it. In fact, tech executives have openly predicted that AI advancement will lead to widespread job loss. There is no positive vision of AI that has been offered in the U.S. as a way to anchor what people's relationship to this technology should be, says Dr. Singh. By contrast, he says many other countries have approached AI with a more intentional vision and have sought to connect AI development with a problem their country needs to solve. In Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, for example, AI is presented as an economic tool to help those countries diversify an oil-dependent economy and thus drive growth. They are using AI to help build up new industries, including tech and tourism, as well as attract investment from other countries. In Japan, AI robots are viewed as a way to help people care for elderly relatives in a country with an aging population. For some developing countries, AI development represents a chance to leapfrog or catch up with the rest of the world. For example, India aims to become a global AI garage by creating AI tools that other countries will want to use. The differing narrative is why some people are willing to place more trust or be more optimistic about an AI future than in the U.S., says Dr. Singh. AI development in the U.S. tends to be focused on achieving theoretical milestones, like artificial general intelligence, defined as machines or software that replicate human intelligence. Baobao Zhang, an associate professor at Syracuse University who studies public and elite opinion toward AI, says the goals are completely different in countries such as China. In those places, the focus is more about using AI to tangibly improve people's lives in areas such as healthcare, education, and science. For example, China is a global leader in trials for AI healthcare use and in testing self-driving cars. In the U.S., she says, it just seems more that consumers are being burdened with the risks and potential harms. Where AI fosters mistrust. Views on AI can differ depending on its application. For example, public polling shows that people around the world, including Americans, are generally excited about AI's potential to support healthcare, spur scientific innovation, and perform convenient tasks such as forecasting the weather. But Americans balk at a number of other applications that they fear will make society worse, not better. Large majorities believe that AI will decrease the number of available job opportunities by automating tasks normally done by humans. Scams and misinformation are also a concern reflected in American public opinion, as is the belief that AI will make people worse at thinking creatively and forming meaningful relationships. People in the U.S. feel like they don't have a choice when it comes to AI, says Dr. Zhang. She cites her university students as an example. In a pinched labor market, she says they tell her they feel compelled to use AI to more easily apply for hundreds of job positions. But at the same time, AI feels like a growing threat to those students' work prospects. It might be used to interview them, screen their applications, or even automate the jobs they hope to land. The apprehension is strong enough that several college commencement speakers this spring were booed when they mentioned AI. Right now, it feels like for a lot of people, they don't have much say and control over how AI is being used, Dr. Zhang adds. It is either forced upon them, or they feel like they have to acquiesce to it in order to keep their job. The Kosovo War devastated these widows' village. They found strength in one another. Farij Hoti, founder of the KB Krusha Agricultural Cooperative, helps women to heal 27 years after a massacre in their village. By Isabel de Pomero, Krusha e Made, Kosovo. The bus full of women from the KB Krusha Agricultural Cooperative has barely pulled away from the factory when its founder, Farij Hoti, rises from her seat. Albanian folk songs, raw and full of longing, crackle through the bus speakers as Ms. Hoti steps into the aisle, takes her young twin granddaughters by the hand, and begins to sing and dance. "Aren't we more beautiful than ever?" she calls out. The women around her, many of them ethnic Albanian widows from the village of Krusha e Made in western Kosovo, are more than employees in the cooperative. They are a group bound by grief, survival, and the hard work of rebuilding after the war in Kosovo shattered their worlds nearly three decades ago. On this March morning, International Women's Day, Ms. Hoti is taking the women across the mountains to Albania as a gesture of thanks for their efforts and a reminder that loss does not have to define the limits of a life. Like some of the other women, Besire Duraku steps into the aisle to dance. a widow left with small children after a massacre in their village. She defied her family to join Ms. Hoti's cooperative and has never looked back. "Work is where we found our strength," says Ms. Duraku. "It's where we found each other." A difficult journey. Though Cruche Emade is a family farming hub known for its fertile soil, Ms. Hoti did not start out in agriculture. After marrying young, she moved into her husband's large traditional household, caring for her daughter and embroidering wedding dresses in gold thread, a craft passed down through generations of village women. By 1989, Slobodan Milosevic had stripped Kosovo of its autonomy, pushing ethnic Albanians out of jobs, schools, and public life. "We didn't really pay attention," says Ms. Hoti. "As young people, we thought life was ahead of us." Then came March 25, 1999, when Serbian forces entered Cruce Emade. Men and older boys were separated from women and taken away. In the end, 241 civilians were killed or went missing in one of the worst massacres of the war. 64 bodies from Cruce Emade, including that of Ms. Hoti's husband, were never found. Ms. Hoti had fled on foot to Albania with her infant son and young daughter. When she returned 3 months later, after NATO airstrikes had forced Serbian troops out, the village was unrecognizable. Fields ransacked, farm animals killed, tools destroyed. 11 members of her husband's family were dead. 16 children were left without a father, including her own. "I had to accept my husband did not survive," she recounts in her office. By burning the village to the ground, Serbian forces struck at the heart of its livelihood. Anguished over the fate of her husband and the future of her two children, Ms. Hoti faced another battle: the judgment of a deeply traditional community that expected widows to grieve silently, stay indoors, and depend on others. "The war lasted a short time," says Ms. Hoti, "but the war after the war, that was the difficult one." Ms. Hoti began organizing other widows through protests and campaigns, demanding answers about the fate of the missing and calling on Serbia to reveal their whereabouts. The answers never came. When she learned to drive, a first for a woman in the village, she was mocked. "Going door to door in search of work, she was turned away," she says, "because she was dressed in black mourning clothes." But the group of widows whom Ms. Hoti organized gave her confidence. In 2005, she formed a plan. The widows would produce ajvar, a popular Balkan spread of roasted red peppers, in large quantities, and sell it. They would earn money to feed their children, and by working together, begin to heal. At first, many farmers refused to sell peppers to her, believing that it was demeaning to do business with a woman. The immediate post-war climate was also marked by mistrust. Farmers had often gone unpaid for their produce, and were skeptical that a woman would manage to pay them. So Ms. Hoti grew the vegetables herself. When widows facing family pressure hesitated to join her in producing ajvar in her house, she urged them to make it at home themselves. She would collect the jars and sell them. "The hardest part was convincing the community that we were not doing anything wrong," she says, "because in the end, nobody was going to come and feed our children." Initially, the women displayed jars for sale wherever they could. "Whenever we heard of an event, a street fair, anything, we loaded the van and went," says Ms. Hoti. That is how, in 2008, Mustafa Kastradi, an agricultural engineer with the German Development Agency, GIZ, noticed them. "Impressed by Ms. Hoti's instinct for survival and a determination to learn," he says, he offered training and equipment. With help from GIZ and later other international groups, Ms. Hoti formalized the cooperative in 2010 and moved into her first dedicated workspace in 2014. In 2019, when a fire destroyed her small factory, Germany was the first to help her rebuild. She calls its support her pillar of growth. In 2021, the cooperative moved into a modern glass-paneled headquarters. A grant from the European Union covered slightly more than half of the 600,000 euro, about $702,000, cost. Securing a loan for the rest was difficult, because like many Kosovar women, Ms. Hoti lacked collateral. She remembers sleepless nights. Then, she says, Albania's former ambassador to Kosovo talked with banks on her behalf and rallied private investors around the project, support that grew out of a history of solidarity between Albania and the people of Kosovo. Changemaker. Ms. Hoti's rise is breathtaking, says Fatin Nagavci, executive director of the business association Organica, who worked in Krushe Emade immediately after the war. The changemaker in her is that she got women to process, to make things, not just to collect and sell. Mr. Nagavci explains, what began as a very sad story turned out to inspire all the other women, he adds. Today, 37 full-time female employees and dozens of seasonal workers at the cooperative produce tens of tons of ajvar a year. Much of it is bound for Europe, and increasingly the United States. Thanks to a vibrant diaspora, Ms. Hoti has become a role model on how to build and grow a business from the ashes, says Hartem Gashi, president of Kosovo's Fruit and Vegetable Processors Association. By enabling widows to transcend expectations and earn incomes, Ms. Hoti helped open a national conversation about women's roles in society. A debate gaining momentum, says Spreson Grulaj, a Kosovo-born scholar at Charles University in Prague. Ms. Hoti is running June 7th to be a deputy in Kosovo's assembly. Women's empowerment, from access to employment to access to land, has become a priority at conferences and in international aid programs, says Daniela Coca, co-founder of EcoCos Women EKW, a non-governmental organization that supports women and girls in rural areas. In recent years, the number of women-led enterprises has surged, she adds. Beyond economics, Ms. Hoti changed the mindset of the whole Krushe Emade, says filmmaker Blurda Basholi, whose 2021 drama, Hive, brought Ms. Hoti's story to global attention. Without Ms. Hoti, she notes, many women might have remained trapped in isolation. Inside the factory. A day before the trip to Albania, the women sit in a bright, high-ceilinged hall, carefully folding fermented cabbage leaves into tight rolls that will be sealed in jars of brine and shipped, ready to be stuffed with minced meat for sarma, a traditional Balkan dish. Ajvar remains the heart of the business, but Ms. Hoti has expanded to 40 products, including pickled vegetables and pepper spreads blended with yogurt, ensuring work through every season. Ms. Hoti moves across the floor with energy, joking and laughing as she oversees production. We've gone through a lot, says Shippi Sejfulahu, a mother of six. We do everything together, singing, crying, sharing difficulties. It helps. Nearby, Fadil Hoti, no relation to Farij Hoti, a widow who joined the cooperative early on, speaks with quiet pride. With my work here, I raised my children, educated them, and married them off, she says. Much has changed in Cruce Aimare since the war. Widows meet for coffee. Women drive. Small Ajvar businesses are sprouting, although few are led by women, notes Farij Hoti. While change is uneven, she continues to meet with war survivors, women's groups, and policymakers. When Ukrainian journalists in exile visited her recently, she offered them a message. I lost my husband. I ran through the forest escaping bullets. And still life continues. Each day she is the first to arrive at the factory and the last to leave. I always show up with a smile, she says. And each day the widows of Cruce Aimare peel vegetables, stir pots, and seal jars. Sometimes they break for coffee and dancing. But always they are building a future. How America's buy-now economy is transforming its heartland. As the U.S. economy evolves to meet Americans' desire for goods to reach them faster than ever, the infrastructure making it possible is transforming parts of Illinois. By Harry Brunius. Elwood and Manhattan, Illinois. On certain evenings in Will County, Illinois, from the raised overpasses that cross its highways, a contrast becomes apparent. Freight trains inch past long grass prairie in long metallic lines. Semi-trucks stream through newly widened intersections and closed-loop designated routes. And beyond them, bison brought back to the region a decade ago graze quietly on protected land. Land that once produced explosives for three American wars. Old U.S. Route 66, too, passes right through it. Along this stretch of the road, two very different parts of America exist side by side. One is the remnant of what Cyrus Avery imagined a century ago when he first proposed Route 66 as the main street of America. Local, optimistic, built around the freedom of the open road and the vast landscapes it crossed. The vision was to connect thousands of local businesses and far-flung communities in a national marketplace. The other side is a logistics system of astonishing speed and precision, and it is central to the current geography of American commerce. Here, that same vision of a connected national marketplace has become less a destination than a continental-scale conveyor belt beneath an American way of life. Centerpoint Intermodal Center sits at the center of this logistics system in a corridor just southwest of Chicago. It receives imported goods from West Coast ports and then delivers them into the American heartland. In just 20 years, Centerpoint has become the central node of the American retail economy. More than 3 million shipping containers pass through the facility every year, carrying an estimated $100 billion in goods before being fanned out in every direction to storefronts and family front doors across the Midwest and beyond. It is served by two Class 1 railroads and two interstate highways. It has 10 square miles of land holding a latticework of rail spurs, regimented stacks of intermodal containers, and rows of wide-span gantry cranes. There are millions of square feet of warehouse space and thousands of big rigs moving goods around the clock. You are in the heartbeat of the country here, says Adam Roth, a longtime leasing agent for Centerpoint and executive vice president of NAI Hithman, a commercial real estate firm. Logistics hubs do not draw the public fascination of artificial intelligence or futuristic robotics, or even the nostalgia that surrounds Route 66. But Centerpoint and hubs like it reveal something equally important about the country Americans have built for themselves. Here, fresh fruit arrives year-round from thousands of miles away. press a digital Buy Now button, and online orders appear at front doors within a day, sometimes hours. A product unloaded from a container ship in Los Angeles can be sitting on a store shelf in Ohio before the week is out. My dad said to me, "It's really interesting that we eat better than pharaohs did," Mr. Roth says, "because they ate whatever was in season, whatever they could get their hands on, whereas we can go and get almost anything, even more, any time of the year." But such abundance also brings an American dilemma, at least on the Main Street level of the country. Centerpoint has already established itself as the largest inland port in North America. Now, another developer, Northpoint, has plans to nearly double the warehouse capacity of the region, and thus the number of trucks. This land the proposal covers is mostly farmland, including small rural towns that also serve as quiet bedroom communities for professionals throughout the Chicago metropolitan area. There are conflicts, competing visions clashing, and the stakes are high. As America's logistics machine keeps expanding, the benefits include lower costs and greater convenience for U.S. consumers. That expansion might be progress, another stage in Avery's original vision of a grand national marketplace. That progress, however, can be measured against the disruption of the daily lives of the people who live here, some of them in a small town just a few miles down the road. 2. On a sunny Friday afternoon in May, John Kiken and his brother-in-law, Ron Adamski, are driving down a historic stretch of Route 66, now Illinois Route 53, pointing out the new North Point warehouses that line parts of the road. Both men have been fighting the developers' planned expansion, which, according to current proposals, would impinge upon their homes in Manhattan, Illinois, less than 10 miles away. A quiet community, great people. They take care of each other, always willing to help out, says Mr. Adamski, a Gulf War veteran who served on the aircraft carrier USS America and a retired air traffic controller. It's that type of community, and we're getting swallowed up by the outside forces. Northpoint is seeking to acquire some 4,000 acres, or about 6 square miles of farmland and other residential areas, and expand the existing landscape of warehouses and truck routes into parts of their small rural town. Not everyone in the surrounding communities is against the plan. Some who agreed to sell their land saw deals fall apart after Mr. Adamski and Mr. Keekin brought legal challenges. They weren't happy with them, the men say. Mr. Keekin has lived in Manhattan for nearly 40 years. In the 1980s, he was an electrical engineer at Inland Steel in East Chicago, Indiana. The 40-mile commute was brutal, he says, but he came home to the prairie every night because the prairie was the point. Go outside day or night, and all you hear are the sounds of either farming or nature, he says from the back seat during the drive. You don't hear the trucks. You don't hear the sounds of a city. And this is going to change all that. He has already been a part of a major transformation of American industry. Inland was bought out in 1998 as the U.S. steel industry waned. Mr. Keekin switched careers, teaching himself web design at a crucial moment of social and economic change, and founding Midwestern Industries, a tech company he still runs today, without a commute. Mr. Adamski arrived just 7 years ago, seeking the quietude of rural life, and buying a house in a new subdivision of modest homes. It has become something of a bedroom community, the town being the southern terminus of a commuter railway connected to Chicago's Union Station. You should have more say when someone wants to put a monstrosity right at the edge of your boundaries, he says, gesturing at hundreds of acres of farmland on Cherry Hill Road, not far from where he lives. In 2020, the two men co-founded the grassroots organization Stop North Point, and today they are part of an ongoing quality of life lawsuit against the developer. It coalesced after Mr. Adamski won a seat on the village board, part of a wave election that replaced supporters of economic development and brought in leaders broadly sympathetic to the anti-warehouse cause. 3 years after Mr. Adamski's election, the Manhattan Village Board voted 6-0 to formally stop join the Stop North Point lawsuit against the developer and the city of Joliet. Mr. Adamski, whose name is on the lawsuit, abstained from the vote, seeing a conflict of interest as a public official. He had given the movement its foothold in village government. Now, in a final act of civic scruple, he stepped aside and let the village carry it forward on its own. 3. Large forces of history have converged in Will County before. Decades ago, Center Point's land was occupied by the Joliet Army Ammunition Plant, which opened in 1940. To build it, the U.S. government displaced those living on 450 family farms, most through negotiated purchases, but others through eminent domain. At its peak, the Joliet arsenal employed more than 10,000 people and produced more TNT than any facility in the world. It made the majority of American munitions for World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. Most work at the arsenal stopped in 1976, the nation's bicentennial, and it was later abandoned and declared a Superfund site. In 1996, Congress subdivided the land. Almost 20,000 acres were used to create the Mitowin National Tallgrass Prairie, a nature preserve, to bring back the original landscape before the farms came. Bison were brought here in 2015. Another 1,000 acres were used to create the Abraham Lincoln National Cemetery, now the second largest military cemetery by acreage in the country. The transformation of the toxic site included granting Center Point about 2,000 acres of land as part of a wider agreement with federal, state, and local officials to clean it up. The company also received at least $150 million in public tax financing, along with agreements that local authorities would provide necessary infrastructure. Its proposal to the small town of Elwood in the early 2000s promised an economic boom. The pitch included an estimated 12,000 well-paying new jobs. Elwood was enthusiastic, and it gave the developer 20 years without having to pay property taxes. By 2013, however, Elwood sued the center. It claimed the project had produced only about 3,800 jobs, most of them low-wage warehouse work, and brought in less than half the projected tax revenue from economic activity. Instead, the lawsuit said, truck traffic and road maintenance had overwhelmed the village. On top of that, the town was $30 million in debt from costs of providing infrastructure. That lawsuit marked an important turning point. Elwood shifted from an enthusiastic partner to an increasingly vocal critic of the logistics hub it had helped build. The city of Joliet also had legal disputes with the developer over the years. But in June 2025, the city council unanimously approved a settlement resolving years of regional litigation. Under the settlement, truck traffic must now flow through a closed-loop road network designed to keep semis off residential streets, a major concession to community opponents. Critically for taxpayers, the city shed what attorneys estimate as hundreds of millions of dollars in road and bridge maintenance liability. But that's nearly 10 miles from Manhattan, through which more and more trucks are already starting to pass. Many carry the intermodal containers that have dramatically changed how quickly a shirt or a TV or a bunch of bananas can arrive at a neighborhood supercenter or be left on a front porch. 4. For most of the nation's history, the great choke points of commerce sat at the water's edge: Baltimore, New Orleans, New York, Los Angeles. Then came the intermodal container, the standard size steel box that crosses oceans on a ship, transfers to a rail car without being unloaded, and then arrives by truck at a warehouse. That single invention made a second generation of ports possible, far from any ocean. BNSF Railway joined CenterPoint to launch the new intermodal center in 2002. Walmart was among the first large retailers to see its efficiencies in 2006, and it now occupies 3.5 million square feet of space. Union Pacific Railroad connected its spurs to the facility in 2010, and Amazon came in 2015. The center now has 4 million square feet. Dozens more retailers and third-party shippers have arrived during the past decade. People say Walmart is really a logistics company disguised as a retailer. That's how important logistics is now, says Mr. Roth, the leasing agent who was instrumental in bringing the nation's largest retailer to the complex. It used to be, "Oh yeah, this is the person that books trucks," Mr. Roth says. Now it's about the rise of the chief supply chain officer as one of the most important executives in any retail company. During a drive through the complex, as Mr. Roth explains the site's history and current occupants, his phone rings often. CenterPoint still has hundreds of acres on site to develop, and he's working on another deal. 5. After driving through parts of Joliet and Elwood, Mr. Keekin and Mr. Adamski head back to their hometown of Manhattan. They note the truck traffic. At least two or three semis pass through every minute or so. At one intersection on State Street, they point out a corner where a 14-year-old boy was struck and killed by a truck. "That stop sign was the result of that accident," Mr. Adamski says. About 20,000 trucks pass through neighboring Joliet every day, according to a recent analysis. While many use the interstates and direct routes to the intermodal center or surrounding warehouses, about 6,000 per day use local routes and highways, passing through communities such as Manhattan. Mr. Adamski recalls incidents in which truck drivers, disoriented by the maze of access roads, were regularly turning into the Abraham Lincoln National Cemetery by mistake, and in at least one case, driving over graves. "That gets you fired up if you're a veteran," he says. As a result of the accidental truck traffic, the cemetery built a roundabout so they could safely turn back to the road. Joliet's legal settlement has frustrated the two men, but they got a recent boost. After much of the Stop North Point lawsuit was tossed, an appellate court reinstated its quality of life claims. Mr. Keekin sacrificed to make Manhattan his home. "After 4 decades living here, he'll fight to the end," he says. "We go to Midewin, National Tallgrass Prairie, all the time," Mr. Adamski says. "I'm a veteran, and so I'm connected to Abraham Lincoln National Cemetery. There's just beautiful places here where we live. We want to keep them." 6. CenterPoint and the logistics corridor it anchors is not an ugly place. Most of the warehouses here are less than 15 years old. Trains enter slowly, surrounded by restored prairie. It is massive, but it is not loud. We've had people over the years come and tour, and they're expecting it to be more of a beehive, and it's kind of not, says Mr. Roth. For generations, Americans have repeatedly remade this landscape in pursuit of new forms of prosperity and connection. Canals, railroads, highways, factories, suburbs, logistics hubs. Each transformation brought growth and disruption at once, creating wealth and mobility while reshaping the lives of the people who happened to live where the next system needed to go. And it's true, trucks are essential in this logistics system that has risen up to serve the demands of the new digital economy. In any development, especially anything of this magnitude, you're going to have proponents and you're going to get people that aren't in favor of it, Mr. Roth says. Some people are going to look at the larger economy. It's really a matter of your perspective and what benefits that person. West Laraway Road connects Centerpoint to the intersection of Old Route 66, about a mile from the site. On a late Friday afternoon in May, a line of semi-trucks and other vehicles stretches for hundreds of yards, driven by the ceaseless demand of a new American economy. Ceasefire in name only. Israel expands military campaign in Lebanon. Despite a U.S.-brokered ceasefire for Lebanon reached in April, the Israeli military's campaign against Iran-backed Hezbollah is expanding. By Scott Peterson, London. Israel further escalated its long-running war against Iran-backed Hezbollah militants in Lebanon on Monday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered new airstrikes in Beirut's Hezbollah-controlled southern suburbs, one day after Israel recaptured the 900-year-old Beaufort Castle in southern Lebanon. The Israeli military has stepped up attacks in southern Lebanon in recent days, warning hundreds of thousands of people to evacuate their homes, including from the entire coastal city of Tyre last week. Israel's campaign has complicated diplomatic efforts to end the U.S.-Israel war against Iran, launched in late February. Iran is suspending its participation in indirect talks with the United States to protest the Israeli military campaign in Lebanon. According to Iran's Tasnim News Agency, which is affiliated with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Soon after that report, President Donald Trump put out a statement on social media suggesting that Iran would not walk away from negotiations with the U.S. He also wrote that he spoke with Mr. Netanyahu and indirectly with Hezbollah, and that Israel will not attack them and they will not attack Israel. Despite a Washington-brokered ceasefire announced in mid-April, Israel has escalated its attacks in Lebanon, and Hezbollah has been retaliating. The group has hit back against Israeli forces, now occupying a swath of southern Lebanon, and has also targeted northern Israel. Residents of Beirut's southern suburb of Dahiyeh clogged exit routes on Monday, after the latest Israeli evacuation warning. Israel also reported the death of one soldier, killed by a Hezbollah drone near Beaufort Castle, a strategic hilltop in southern Lebanon that served as an Israeli military base during a previous Israeli occupation. There will be no situation in which Hezbollah attacks our cities and our citizens, and its terrorist headquarters in Beirut, in Dahiyeh, will remain out of bounds, Mr. Netanyahu said. On Sunday, Mr. Netanyahu hailed the recapture of the castle. "We've returned to Beaufort united, determined, and stronger than ever," he said. Iranian officials who became targets during a devastating 40-day U.S.-Israeli bombing campaign insist that a ceasefire in Lebanon be included in any U.S.-Iran ceasefire agreement. For weeks, negotiators have sought to reconcile a U.S. 20-point plan and an Iranian 14-point plan, as the White House aims to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and bring down global energy prices. Those Iran negotiations mean Mr. Netanyahu will feel more pressure from Washington not to further escalate in Lebanon. Andreas Krieg, a security expert at King's College London, told Al Jazeera, "Israel is stuck in permacrisis and war with no end in sight. Occupying Lebanese territory is a recipe to strengthen Hezbollah in the eyes of many Lebanese as the only force able to stop Israel's encroachments on Lebanon's territory," he said. Hezbollah is still alive and kicking, and the northern communities in Israel are still under threat from Hezbollah. So Netanyahu is under immense pressure to show something, even if he has to concede ultimately to American pressure to cease operation. Dr. Krieg said, "Israel's capture of Beaufort Castle brought a new sense of deja vu for Israeli forces, which attacked the medieval fortress repeatedly when the Palestine Liberation Organization occupied it after 1976. Israel itself held control of the castle and built a military outpost adjacent to it. During Israel's occupation of a self-declared security zone in southern Lebanon from 1982 to 2000. During the current conflict, UNESCO has listed the castle as cultural property under enhanced protection, while raising the flags of Israel in the Israeli Army's Golani Brigade over the castle was heralded at home, some questioned the strategy behind Israel's expanding ground offensive. Instead of raising the questions that must be asked about the dubious strategy of the war in the north and the lack of a solution to the threat of exploding drones guided by fiber optic cables, of which Hezbollah is launching dozens every day, we got a nostalgic outpouring about this thrilling return to a historic site," analyst Amos Harrell wrote in Haaretz about the raising of the flags over the castle Sunday. "Almost no one is talking about what happened and what we lost there the last time," wrote Mr. Harrell. Okay, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you.